It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
This is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Negro National League, where some of baseball's greatest stars played in the days of racial segregation. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, there were several reunions of Negro League players in Ashland, Kentucky, thanks to the work of a young newspaper man named Tom Stultz, who owned the Greenup County Sentinel. Today, Tom is the president of JMI Sports, the official multimedia rights and corporate sponsorship partner of the University of Kentucky. The Negro League Hall of Fame was in Ashland for a brief time, but was relocated to Kansas City, where today the Negro League's Baseball Museum honors the players and their era. Bob Kendrick is the museum president. Two great guests. Hope you enjoy listening. Tom Stultz is with us today. He's president of JMI Sports. He works with universities, athletic conferences, professional teams, private entities, and municipalities, and developing media strategies, business plans to increase client revenues and fund major capital projects. Of course, JMI maintains a close association with the University of Kentucky. And Tom, we'll be talking with you today, though. Well, we could do certainly a separate podcast on all of that. We'll be talking with you today about something that happened much earlier in your career, back in the 1970s. So we'll get into that. But first of all, good to have you with us. Thanks for being on today.
Oh, thank you, Keith. It's a pleasure.
I wanted to talk with you about the Negro League baseball reunions that you helped organize back in the 1970s. You were with the Ashland Daily Independent as a reporter at that time. And for those that are not familiar with Negro League baseball, of course, prior to 1947, when Jackie Robinson joined the Brooklyn Dodgers, baseball was segregated, whites only. And before that, there were leagues that were for Black and Latino players dating back to the 1880s, and probably the golden era of Negro baseball was in the 1920 when the Negro National League was started, and some great, great players who were later recognized and now are part of baseball's Hall of Fame played in those leagues from 1920 until the early 1950s. Players like Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige, Oscar Charleston, Cool Papa Bell, Monty Irvin, many, many others. And so it's become just a great part of baseball history. And before we get to the specifics on the events in Ashland, maybe just your thoughts on that era of Negro League baseball. Most baseball fans, when they get into it, find it really fascinating.
You know, just a real quick update on you know, the timeline. I actually started out as a reporter for the Ashland Daily. And at age 22, my wife and I started a weekly newspaper called the Greenup County Sentinel in my hometown of Greenup, Kentucky. And it was there that we sponsored the first Negro baseball reunion in 1979. So I had left the Ashland Daily, but we did have that reunion both in Greenup, Kentucky and in Ashland. And it turned out to be the first ever for the old Negro League players, which was a real, real honor to have fall in our laps as we started out with that. But it's true, you know, the more you study about the old Negro Leagues, you realize, like many things in our society, what an injustice it was to some great, talented people that they would be restricted and unable to display their talents with everybody else because of their race. And there were some incredible players in there. You know, that was the league that really produced Jackie Robinson and Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and Ernie Banks, as well as a whole bunch of guys like Satchel and Cool Papa that, I think Satchel played some of the big leagues, but way past his prime, and the other guys never got their shot. And it's one of those injustices that you can't undo, but it is important that these guys be recognized, and not just for how good they were playing among themselves, but how successful they were when they did barnstorming games against some of the great white teams of that time.
Yeah, and you mentioned guys like Mays and Banks, who came along right at the end of the Negro League era and then later became stars in the big leagues. But they were the fortunate ones in terms of the timing, and as you say, so many, many others did not get that opportunity. At the same time, they had great careers in the Negro Leagues, and they many of them, we're talking about the late 70s now, were still with us and still active and still able to travel, and so we're able to participate in this in the reunions. Mark Maynard of the Ashland Daily Independent did a nice story on the reunions a few years ago, and in that story he mentioned that the idea for the reunions started with conversations of a family friend of yours, Horace Thomas, whom everyone knew as Choppy. Well, tell me about that and the origin of the whole thing.
You know, Choppy Thomas was a longtime family friend. He worked at my granddad's drugstore in Greenup, and they were pranksters together. I can't remember a single holiday that we weren't together with Choppy and B. Thomas and our family. And my brother and I grew up playing baseball, and both of us had scholarships to play at college. He actually played. I caught batting practice, but it was a time where we would talk to Choppy, and he would say, "My brother Clint played a little ball," and we just kind of shook it off as kids that, you know, thought more about ourselves, I guess, than we did about Clint's brother or Choppy's brother, who we'd never met. And he advanced a number of years later, and a magazine shows up in my mailbox at our weekly newspaper about Clint Thomas being one of a handful of guys from the old Negro Leagues that were eligible for induction into Cooperstown. And I understand, I read that article, and it struck me that Choppy's brother, who played a little ball, was a whole lot better than I was and a whole lot better than most people, and nobody ever heard of him. And, you know, move people from, or when they do comparisons of the guys from the old Negro Leagues at that time, they would compare them to contemporary white players. And Clint Thomas was known as the Black Joe DiMaggio. That's how they compared him, but what kind of a hitter and center fielder he was. And it just, you know, it really hit me that Clint was a guy that, you know, is selling coffee at a little stand at the Charleston, West Virginia State House, and his counterpart from the White Leagues was selling Mr. Coffee Makers. And, you know, had the roles been reversed, you know, Clint could have been right there and had the same type of notoriety and fame and fortune. So we decided that it would make sense to have a big birthday party to honor Clint. And I got hold of Monty Irwin as I was doing my own story about Clint and for the weekly. And Monty gave me the names and phone numbers for a lot of the former players that had played with Clint. And as I called them, I was shocked that, A, that, you know, that they thought Clint was dead. They'd lost complete touch with him. And I was also kind of surprised that they had never really gotten together. So, somewhere along that line, as we developed it, we decided to bring him in for sort of a birthday party for Clint and to celebrate. And said, you know, we'd like to make this bigger than just, you know, just having it in Greenup. What if we tied it in Regatta? And he liked that idea and put us in touch with that. So it became kind of a Greenup Ashland event in 1979 that the media then covered and announced that it was the first ever reunion of the old Negro League players. And we just thought we were honoring Clint Thomas, but it turned out to be one of those big things that got, you know, it was on the evening news of NBC. It was in the International Herald Tribune, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Sports Illustrated, and we had about 13 or 14 players and other people associated with that era come in for that event.
And as you said, as you began to get in touch with them and then realized that they had not seen each other for many years, and their excitement must have come through over the phone when you talked to them about the idea of just touching base again.
It was great. And you know, we had a number of guys that came in that have since been inducted in the Hall of Fame. Ray Dandridge, Turkey Stearns are two that come to mind. And both of those were just so excited about just the recognition to see their old players and rekindle the friendships. We had a number of the players, former players, staying at our house in Greenup, and the others we put up in a hotel over in South Point, Ohio. And they just sat around the living room and told stories. And I wish that we had videotape of that because it was priceless. Mm-hmm. Then we had, you know, they kind of played out in the backyard with some of the neighborhood kids and kids from all over Greenup. we had a reception for him at City Hall. And then the next night we had a big dinner in Ashland around the Tri-State Charing Regatta. And these guys who'd been telling all these wonderful stories about when they played, who they played, and some of them were funny, and a lot of them were about how, you know, how good some of these players were. At the banquet, it was a different mood. It was more emotional. It was like somebody is finally recognizing us. And, you know, Green up in Ashland, which probably didn't have any business hosting that thing, became a real, real focus point for sort of the history of the old Negro Leagues.
Now, of course, once it did work, you, as you mentioned, you had some very distinguished guests at your house, some of baseball's biggest names from that era. Now, you were the organizer, and, of course, you're wanting the event to go well and checking on things, I'm sure, but you also had to be a baseball fan, enjoying himself very much, just having these great names there and carrying on their conversations. There had to be a little bit of that emotion in you, too, wasn't there?
There was a whole lot of that in me. I'm a wannabe major leaguer that didn't make it, so yes.
And you mentioned some of the stories. Were they mainly sharing just things about playing days? I guess what I'm getting to is, did they ever express any bitterness or anything toward society in general or baseball during the conversations there, or was it mainly just a matter of being happy to get back together again?
There was a number of things. I didn't sense any bitterness, but I'm not sure they would have shown that anyway, given the environment of all that. I think they appreciated that, even though they weren't making as much as Babe Ruth and the other guys in the White League, they were doing better than most African Americans at that time. So they felt, you know, kind of mixed on that. One, the potential, the biggest regret was not being able to showcase their skills against the legends of the game that all the media and all the fans were covering. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the biggest part of that. It's just, you know, they really were that good, and I think they would love to, like anybody that's really good at something, you want to compete against the best, and they were stolen. They had that opportunity stolen from them.
And you mentioned that Clint Thomas was referred to as the Black DiMaggio, and of course, had Clint Thomas been able to play in the major leagues, he would not have needed his name attached to anybody. It would be like calling Willie Mays the Black DiMaggio. In other words, you know, he would have achieved stardom on his own. Baseball, just at that time in the 70s, was just beginning to recognize some of the players with a Negro League committee to look into the possibility of inducting some of them into the Hall of Fame, and that was just beginning to happen at that time.
Yeah, it really was. There were books published, like, you know, Only the Ball Was White. Mm-hmm. And a guy named John Holman had a book out about the Negro Leagues, and those things were starting to get some of the recognition and attract the attention that the guys deserved years ago.
Again, I'll credit Mark Maynard in the Daily Independent for a story that he wrote just a few years ago. But you were quoted in that story that about having a thank you card from African Americans in Greenup and in that area. Tell me about that.
You know, Greenup was one of the early places to fully integrate their schools and. You know, we grew up, we hopefully we were colorblind. And when we had the reunion, then most of the my friends from the Black community in Greenup came over to the house and they went to the event. And my basement tonight is a autographed thank you card from just about every African-American in my hometown. And I wouldn't take $1 zillion for it.
Mm-hmm. Was there any one individual Negro League star that you remember meeting and talking with that stood out? I'm sure you're glad to meet all of them, but anybody in particular that remains a strongest memory at this point?
You know, one Turkey Stearns came in late, and he was a great player in the old Negro Leagues, and I had sent a bunch of guys invitations, and his daughter called me about a week before and said that that her mom had passed away and that she saw the invitation on the dresser and wanted to bring her dad. And Turkey came in. He's so shy. He wouldn't sit on the podium with all the players. He sat back in the crowd at the dinner and got up and spoke. And then a few months later, there was a great story on him out of the reunion in the Detroit newspapers where he lived. And a few months later, he passed away, and I got invited to be a pallbearer at his funeral. So and I didn't get to go because I was on deadline in my newspaper, and it's one of the big regrets of my life that I didn't get to go, and one of the greatest honors of my life that he would ask me to do that. Posthumously, he was inducted into Cooperstown and is in the Hall of Fame today.
And this series of events here in Ashland and Greenup in the late 70s, eventually things moved on to Kansas City as a center of Negro League history. Now, and you yourself moved on from the Ashland area, I guess, early 80s, is that right?
Yeah, in 1980, my wife and I sold our paper and we moved. And Ashland Oil, Harry Wiley, and the Tri-State Fair and Regatta kept the reunion going, and they made it an annual event for three or four more years. They went, I think we had 14 people there at our first one. They had 40-some at each of the next few. They honored Satchel, Cool Papa, Willie Mays. I mean, they brought in Monty Irwin, Buck O'Neill, I think. So, and then somewhere in the middle of that, maybe year three, Harry and his group announced that they were going to open a Negro Baseball Hall of History or something in Ashland, and they started collecting a bunch of stuff for that, but it never fully developed. And then a few years later, Buck O'Neill, you know, created the Negro Baseball Reunion in Kansas City. So I was far enough from, I was removed from that, so I don't know how closely connected they were. But I think if you hadn't had the reunions and the tradition that Harry Weil and his group kept carrying on in Ashland, I don't think you would have had the museum in Kansas City.
And, of course, that museum is doing well today under the direction of Bob Kendrick, who's very active in organizing events and raising funds and keeping that history alive. And, again, just to come back to our original point, Tom, if anyone who's a baseball fan at all, this is great that this history is being kept alive, and this is a great opportunity to learn. You mentioned the book Only the Ball Was White. That's usually the title that comes up when people recommend a good way to find out about the Negro Leagues. But this is such a rich history, part of American history, and not just sports, but it's certainly something that wouldn't you recommend for any baseball fan to dive into?
Absolutely. It's just part of, it's like in all of our American history. You want to learn the good, the bad, and the ugly, and I think there's plenty of both. If you look at the Negro Leagues, it's really ugly and bad that they weren't given the chance to play on the biggest stage, but at the same time, they were great players, and we can learn a lot from them.
Well, Tom, we appreciate your efforts back then as baseball fans and have this to look back to a great connection to the great Negro League baseball players from as part of that event in Greenup and Ashland, and now saluted in Cooperstown and in the museum in Kansas City as well. So that has carried on. I know this is a great source of satisfaction for you. And, again, congratulations on your efforts then, and we appreciate you being with us.
Thanks, Keith. It's been a pleasure.
Bob Kendrick is with us today, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, honoring the great players in the era of Negro League baseball from 1920 to 1960. Some of baseball's greatest players played in the Negro Leagues, but because of the segregation of that era, never in the National League or the American League until Jackie Robinson joined the Brooklyn Dodgers and broke the color barrier in 1947. Bob has won many awards for his work there in Kansas City with the museum, including induction into the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame back in 2014. Bob, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Keith, it's great to be with you, man. Thanks so much for having me.
Congratulations, of course, on all the success with the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. This is a big year for you. The founding date of 1920 means that this is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Negro National League. I have a feeling that had things not developed as they have over the last couple of months, that you would probably be headed for a ballpark somewhere to help the fans celebrate and commemorate that 100th anniversary. I'm sure you had a very, very busy schedule planned for this time of the year, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. And, you know, I think that's been part of the disappointment, along with having to shut down the museum and people not getting an opportunity to enjoy this museum at a time that is so critical for the museum with the launching of our 100th anniversary celebration, a year-long celebration that we had planned. And so a lot of those plans have been tabled a little bit. But, yeah, just, you know, the sound of play ball and what that means to the Negro Leagues Museum, because we would be going right now into that part of our tour season come May, and fans coming out to experience the Royals and make their way to see the Negro Leagues Museum, and us traveling to ballparks all over the country, again, celebrating its rich history. And so right now, some of that has been tabled, but we're optimistic that we'll be able to get back on the road with this story and get this celebration back in full swing.
Well, going back 100 years now, Rube Foster was the key figure at the time in the founding of the Negro National League. The Negro American League came along later. Tell me about Rube Foster and his role in the founding of the Negro National League.
Well, in my estimation, Rube Foster is the greatest baseball mind this sport has ever seen that very few folks know anything about, but they should. Mm-hmm. Rube Foster, he was an absolute genius. He was so far ahead of his time. And as you touched upon, it would be Foster who would organize the meeting that took place here in Kansas City, February 13, 1920, when he signed into establishment the Negro National League. That meeting took place at the old Paseo YMCA, just right around the corner from where the museum currently operates. And so for those who kind of wondered why a Negro Leagues Museum is now in Kansas City, well, Kansas City is the birthplace of these leagues. And so that meeting took place in 1920. Foster would become the president of the Negro Leagues. He would bring in his Chicago American Giants. Foster had been a great player in the pre-era of the Negro League, the early era of black baseball. He was a great manager and a great executive. So you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who contributed more to the game of baseball on all levels than the great Andrew Rube Foster. He is rightfully enshrined in the National Baseball Hall of Fame, but he's still not a household name, and he should be. Yeah, Rube as a manager was so innovative. He would draw circles down both the first and third base line. And if every one of his players could drop a bunt inside that circle, man, he would find them. If they were tagged out standing up, he would find them. You know, he preached that very style of play that became signature in Negro Leagues baseball. Fast, aggressive, daring. And he had the wherewithal to make what others had attempted to do, and that was create a successful organized Negro League, but had failed. Rube had the wherewithal to get it done. And so he plays an important role in the history of black baseball in this country.
And, of course, the teams were set up in many of the cities that had major league teams. And so you had fan bases there, I would think, that the fans could come out and support the Negro League teams. And it certainly became a huge event and really more as much of a cultural event as a sports event. Tell me about the environment at a Negro League game, and especially maybe at some of those exhibitions in cities that didn't have teams. It was a huge event when those guys came to town, and the communities really turned out, didn't they?
Oh, they turned out in huge numbers. You know, one of my pet peeves is like, and I know that people mean well, and they'll say, well, you know, it's a shame that nobody saw them play. No, there were a lot of somebodies that saw them play. They just happened to be black. Right. They were filling up ballparks, many of them, as you alluded to, major league stadiums. They were filling these places up. And because you have to remember that a lot of the major league stadiums, if they allowed black folks in to watch a game, we were isolated into a section of the ballpark and separated by chicken wire. Mm-hmm. So it was a very small section of the ballpark if black fans were allowed in. So now Negro League Baseball brings that baseball-hungry African-American fan something that they could now see and enjoy and embrace. And you're right. It created this atmosphere in many African-American communities across this country that were thriving due to in large part to the success of black baseball. And you had this marriage of baseball and entertainment that was second to none. And so when you went to a Negro Leagues game, you were going to be thoroughly entertained. It doesn't mean that you weren't going to see great, fundamentally sound baseball, but you're going to see a level of athleticism and a level of entertainment that people still talk about to this very day. And because they understood that this game had to have some entertainment value to it as well. And of course, you had this plethora of great star power that was there supporting this. So all the great jazz stars and the black entertainers, they're all there. And so it was such a festive environment when you went to those games. And again, as the late, great Buck O'Neill, my dear friend, would say, man, you couldn't go to the concession stand because you might miss something you ain't never seen before.
Yeah. Well, Buck O'Neill was certainly the face and voice, I would think it's fair to say, of Negro League baseball for many years, and of course was a great part of the leagues when they were operating. And then later on, we were fortunate that Buck lived a long time and was healthy for most of those 90-plus years and was able to be a spokesman for the league. He was quite instrumental in not only the operation of the league and the success of the leagues at the time that they were in business, but later on in preserving the history too, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was in many ways the voice. He became this great ambassador, not just for Negro League history, but for baseball in general, but certainly the role that he carried out in this lot of life as it pertained to the Negro Leagues were vital. And Ken Burns, as you well know, gave him a platform with his epic documentary on the history of baseball. And there was Buck O'Neill, as I oftentimes say, this very charming, gentle man who was telling these wonderful baseball stories to baseball fans that they had never heard before. And he did it with a smile that lit up the screen and a twinkle in his eye. And America fell in love with Buck. He was 82 years old at that time. And I'll never forget the headline in the Kansas City Star after the premiere of Buck's part of baseball says, a star is born at 82.
At 82, yes. Well, he certainly was a terrific presence for baseball in general and certainly for the Negro Leagues. As a kid in the 50s and 60s, when I would read baseball magazines, occasionally there would be an article about some of the Negro League players. And usually the first name you hear, at least among my generation, would be that of Josh Gibson, who was, of course, the great slugger and great catcher, who unfortunately ran into some very serious personal problems and passed away at the age of 35, not long before Jackie Robinson broke the color line in Major League Baseball. But tell me a little bit about what you've learned about Josh Gibson over the years.
Well, you know, again, in my own humble opinion, I think you can make a legitimate case that Josh Gibson was the greatest baseball player, not in the Negro Leagues, but in baseball history. Mm-hmm. What Gibson did, and again, Keith, most of the time when we talk about the game's greatest, it usually goes to the center fielder. You know, for Buck O'Neill, it was Oscar Charleston, who was this do-it-all center fielder, a five-tool guy, you know, hit for power, hit for average, could field, could run, could throw. Or in the major leagues, many believe Willie Mays to be the greatest. Because they both played center field. That's that glamour defensive position. But for me, Josh Gibson was a five-tool catcher. And he's playing the most demanding position on the field. And he wasn't a good catcher. He was a great catcher. And so you get this combination, who I believe is the greatest combination of power and average this game has ever seen. And then you couple it with the fact that he was this dominating defensive presence in the catching position. Gibson had a lifetime batting average of .354. And in head-to-head competition in countless exhibition games against Major League All-Star teams, hit over .420. And he was doing it as a catcher.
Yeah.
And he swung a 40-ounce, 41-inch bat, man. The man was just so strong and so powerful. But, again, Buck O'Neill would describe him in this manner, that he had the eyes of Ted Williams and the power of Babe Ruth rolled into one dynamic package. As we say in our sport, his outs were loud outs.
Loud outs.
The third baseman and the shortstop were damn near in left field when Gibson came up. There was no creeping in on Josh. because you could get killed, man. But he was this power hitter who didn't strike out a lot. And everywhere, Keith, that he played, he hit. They recently found, I believe from 1935, his Puerto Rican Winter League numbers. He only hit 485 that season. Yeah, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, those are remarkable numbers, and Josh Gibson, of course, was legendary, as were so many, some of the names that you've already mentioned. And, of course, on the mound, I guess we would about have to start with Satchel Paige, who did pitch in the major leagues as a 42-year-old rookie in 1948. But, of course, the prime of his career, he was in the Negro Leagues, and his pitching exploits, as well as his philosophy of life, were legendary themselves.
Yeah, and we think he was 42.
Yeah, that's right.
There are a lot of folks who believe that he might have been closer to 52 mm-hmm. than 42, that he never told his real age. And his rookie season, if you call 42 being a rookie, his rookie season in the major league, he goes 6-1 with a 2.4 ERA. Mm. I mean, it is absolutely amazing. And for me, Satchel Paige is the benchmark when we talk about pitching greatness. And I'll hear guys who are very partisan to other guys as great pitchers, both in the Negro Leagues and in Major Leagues, they'll say, well, you know, such and such, his fastball was as fast as Satchel, and such was as good as Satchel. But to me, Satchel is that standard. And when you become the standard, you must be pretty doggone good. And Satchel, I tell people all the time, there may have been guys who were just as good. There was no one who was better than Satchel Paige, because Satchel had the complete package. He had everything that you needed to be box office. And that's what is, you know, you look at the game today, you look at athletic, professional sports today, it's about that box office attraction. And Satchel was that. So Satchel had the great stuff. He had the longevity, and he had the charisma. Someone asked me the other day, I was doing a Buster Olney show on ESPN, and he asked me, how would Satchel fare in this world of social media? So Satchel would be one of the biggest stars on the face of the planet.
Oh, yeah.
He was built for social media. Yeah, they would have loved Satchel, and he would have loved social media. And so he was, to me, that's what makes Satchel so special, is that he had everything that you had to have to be a star. And he was one of the biggest stars on the face of the planet then. He would be one of the biggest stars on the face of the planet right now.
Yeah, I can imagine people waiting every day for one of Satchel's tweets, like, don't look back, something might be gaining on you, or what was it, fried food angries up the blood, things like that, the famous quotes of Satchel would be great for the Twitterverse, I think, then these days. I wanted to ask you about another man who's who was a close associate of yours and passed away just a couple of years back, Bob Motley, the umpire. And we were talking about style of play. And as baseball fans, we often say, well, I don't pay for my ticket to see the umpire work. I think in Bob Motley's case, I might have made an exception to see Bob Motley work a game. Tell me about him.
You know, I love Bob Motley. Matter of fact, I just wrote a foreword for the new version of his book that's about to be released. He has a wonderful book called Ruling Over Monarchs, Giants, and Stars, mm-hmm. His Life in the Negro Leagues. And it's the only book that's dedicated to the umpire's perspective of the Negro League. But Bob Motley, to me, epitomizes that, even though he wasn't an athlete, that individual that was associated with the Negro Leagues. He served his country beautifully. He has purple, you know, you see the Purple Heart for his service in World War II. He was a member of the Montford Point Marine Regiment, the first African-American Marine Regiment at that time. And, of course, his work as an umpire in the Negro Leagues, calling the games of the great like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson and Cool Papa Bell and, of course, Buck O'Neill and Willard Brown, who he believed was his favorite ball player ever saw, was a guy named Willard Brown, who is in the Hall of Fame, but not a household name. And Willard Brown was named Home Run Brown by Josh Gibson. And so if Josh Gibson nicknames you Home Run Brown, you must have some power.
That's a pretty good sign of respect.
And Bob was so flamboyant. So he fit right in with the Negro League. We have some amazing photographs. We have a collection here at the Negro Leagues Museum. And you can see a picture of him where he's making this emphatic out call, and he must be 3 feet off the ground, it looks like. You know, I mean, it just, it was, and he had the flair that goes with everything that was really the Negro League. So he fit right in. And again, his book is just a wonderful perspective of the umpire's purview. And a lot of people were surprised to learn that in the Negro League, the umpires rode the buses with the players.
They did, yes.
And so you can imagine what life must have been like if you made a bad call and you got to ride the bus. And he told me, always sit at the very back of the bus, because there's no way you're going to sit with your back turned to any of these guys. And he sat at the very back of the bus, and he always kept his face mask in his hand because he wasn't sure if he was going to have to start swinging it or not. And one of my favorite Bob Motley stories associated with our friend Buck O'Neill. The only time that Buck O'Neill was ever thrown out of a game in his almost 70-year career in the Negro Leagues was by Bob Motley. And it was over a disputed infield fly rule. And I guess Buck said the magic words, and Bob Motley rung him up, kicked him out the game. Well, that night, they had to sleep in the same bed together because it wasn't enough hotel room to go around. And as Buck was saying that beautiful baritone voice of his, he said, "I turned my back to that sucker."
Well, there are some terrific stories from Bob Motley in that book. It's called Ruling Over Monarchs, Giants, and Stars, True Tales of Breaking Barriers, Umpiring Baseball Legends, and Wild Adventures in the Negro Leagues. Bob Motley, M-O-T-L-E-Y, and that photo you mentioned is a classic. If you want to see an umpire with a 40-inch vertical leap, that's the guy making the call at first base. I wanted to ask you about some of the great teams like the Kansas City Monarchs, the Pittsburgh Crawfords, the Homestead Grays from the Negro League era. And again, even though we're talking about an era that was mostly in the first half of the 20th century, there's a very contemporary element of that, and that's the team gear. I go to a ballpark now, and sometimes you'll see a young person, especially with a, or maybe even an older person, with a Kansas City Monarchs jersey on or a cap representing the great teams from that era. That memorabilia is a really nice connection to younger generations, isn't it?
It has been just that, because when we created our licensing program, a lot of people thought we were crazy. They were like, who's going to be interested in that old stuff? Well, I think they didn't realize, or maybe they didn't quite understand, that no sport holds to its history the way baseball does. You know, it's that one sport where we consistently and constantly compare the stars of the past with the stars of today. And it is the most romanticized sport of them all. Whoever your favorite baseball player was when you were a kid, in all likelihood, that person's going to be your favorite baseball player the rest of your life. So it's not surprising to us that baseball fans gravitated to Negro Leagues and Negro Leagues gear. And what it has done for us, number one, outside of helping generate much-needed revenue for our operations, it has become a marketing tool and a tool to educate. So we always try to make sure that our licensees who make this product, that they give you a history of the team that is being represented. And it warms my heart to see people across the country sporting Negro League merchandise, and they're wearing it proudly. And in the process, they're helping keep the legacy of the Negro Leagues alive.
I wanted to ask you about one other highlight on the Negro League schedule every year. They had an all-star game, and we were talking about games being big events. That one was truly a big national event and would sell out big league ballparks. It was quite the spectacle. Tell me about the development, history and development of the Negro League all-star game.
East-West all-star game, as you touched upon, one of the greatest sporting events in American sports history that very few folks know anything about. Debuted in 1933, the same year as Major League Baseball's All-Star Game, and yes, it did outdraw Major League Baseball's All-Star Game. They put over 50,000 fans in Chicago's Comiskey Park for the Negro League version of the All-Star Game. The late, great Buck O'Neill would say that black folks, Keith, would come from as far west as Los Angeles by train, as far south as New Orleans, as far east as New York, converging on Chicago for this showcase event. Again, one of the greatest sporting events in American sports history. You know, because I can tell you right now, to put 50,000 people in Comiskey under any circumstances is no joke. And it was the place that all the stars came out. So, you know, all the great entertainers were going to be at that game. And they were there in groves watching what, in many ways, was even bigger than the Negro League World Series. Because you got the creme de la creme at this thing. And man, they going at it. You know, and so it was a spectacle. And obviously, we talk a lot about the old East-West All-Star Game, which was created by the great Gus Greenlee, who owned the Pittsburgh Crawfords. And it was part of his way to revive the Negro Leagues like it had and much of this country had died during the Great Depression. And Gus Greenlee comes up with the brilliant idea of creating what became the East-West All-Star Game.
It did have a great history and certainly was a tremendous draw, as you said. I wanted to ask you about one of our Kentucky connections with the Negro Leagues. Ashland, Kentucky was the scene of some Negro League reunions in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and for a brief time, Ashland was the home of the Negro League Hall of Fame. Tom Stultz, who's going to be on this program in another segment a little bit later, president of JMI Sports now, was in the newspaper business in Greenup, Kentucky at that time, near Ashland, as the owner of the Greenup County Sentinel, and a friend of his was the brother of Clint Thomas, one of the stars of the Negro League at that time, or in the earlier years, and that led Tom to organizing the reunions. And among the players who made it back at least once were Satchel Paige, Buck O'Neill, Ernie Banks, Monty Irvin, Turkey Stearns, Buck Leonard, Ray Dandridge, Judy Johnson, Ted Page, Willie Mays, and Hank Aaron. So, Bob, obviously that was an idea that really struck home with these former players who had been in the Negro Leagues, and it was a real who's who for those events there in Ashland. That was a great time.
Man, I would have just loved to be able to fly on the wall, because I could imagine there was some lying going on amongst that group. But I'll tell you, the stories that would have been amazing to hear. And that collection of talent that was assembled there in Ashland is as significant as any gathering anywhere. That list of names that you just wrote on, oh, man, that's pretty doggone special. I remember hearing Buck talk about those reunions. We subsequently had a reunion in 1995 here in Kansas City, and one of the largest reunions ever. We had over 250. But so many of those guys that you talked about had passed on and could not be here. And so that congregation of talent there is significant. And I just shook my head when I saw some of the photographs of that gathering. It was a brilliant idea, you know, to see that grow to what it grew into as a celebration of another great ball player who's somewhat unheralded in Clint Thomas. You know, the Hawk could play. You know, people don't realize that we had a Hawk in the Negro League before Andre Dawson.
Yes. Yeah. Clint Thomas from Ashland, Kentucky, and one of the, I guess, the original inspiration in a way for those reunions, which turned out to be great events there in the late 70s and early 80s, as organized by Tom Stultz, who was kind of the energy behind it and as owning the newspaper there locally. And so we'll look forward to having Tom as part of our conversation here a little bit later. Bob, I wanted to ask you some more about the...
Please share my regards with Tom and also share my information, because I would love to talk to him at some point in time.
Okay, I'll be glad to do that, and I'm sure he'd enjoy talking with you as well. There'd be a lot to talk about there, no doubt. In the work of the museum, how would you describe the mission and the goal of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum?
We're celebrating our 30th anniversary. 30 years now. Of preserving and celebrating the rich history of the Negro Leagues, just as importantly, the profound impact that it had on the social advancement of America. And when we started this museum in a little tiny one-room office in 1990, we knew then that it was literally a race against time, that the people who made this story, it wasn't a matter of if, it was simply a matter of when, they were all going to be gone. And it put an additional amount of pressure on this museum to try and gather as much as we could, collect as many stories as we could, to be part of this effort to make sure that the legacy of the Negro Leagues plays on long after there are no Negro League players to attest to the greatness of what these leagues represented. And here we are now 30 years later. It's been an amazing journey for a little museum that no one gave any chance of succeeding because we were building it here in a community that once upon a time was a very prominent African-American community, historic 18th and Vine, the Jazz District. But like a lot of urban areas, it had died. And truth of the matter is you can trace the demise of the Negro Leagues with the demise and the fall of a lot of African-American communities across this country, which had become so dependent on the success of Negro Leagues baseball, which essentially were catalysts for sparking economic empowerment in those communities. And so here we were building this museum in what had become a very depressed, almost abandoned area in 1990. People thought we were crazy. And here we are now 30 years later, recognized as America's National Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And so we've embraced the important role of trying to keep this history alive, but just as important, take the life lessons that are learned from this wonderful story of overcoming adversity and apply it in a relevant fashion so that others, we hope, will not only learn it, but be inspired by it.
And I know you have educational programs there, and you particularly are concerned about reaching out to young people because that's obviously going to be the key to keeping this thing moving forward and remembering that period of time and honoring the players and recognizing that period in history as well. What are some of the ways that you specifically try to get young people into the museum and to try to communicate with them?
Yeah, we're using a litany of educational outreach programs, community outreach programs, to make that connection, because it's so easy for a kid to say, this was then, you know, that was then, this is now. It doesn't apply to me. Well, you know, we see some things that are happening in our society that very eerily look like this. And so I think these kinds of very triumphant stories, because at the crux of this is a civil rights story, Keith, as much as it is a baseball story. Mm-hmm. And through these incredibly courageous athletes, very strong-willed individuals who I like to say forged a glorious history in the midst of an inglorious time in American history. And so their passion for the game of baseball not only changed our sport, it changed our country. And there are some tremendous lessons to be learned from that. And so we started creating programs and then traveling exhibitions to take the story on the road. So we have literacy programs like Reading Around the Bases, where we bring our kids K through fifth grade into the museum, and we have people who are business leaders, athletes, members of the media, very prominent figures in our community, come in and read to our children from Negro League-themed children's books because we want them to demonstrate the value of reading, because that, to me, is the fundamental main thing that you need in the learning process. But then they're also getting this impression about the Negro Leagues. And fortunately for us, there have been a number of Negro League-themed children's books written over the last 10 years or so. We have an art program called Project Retrace, where we bring kids into the museum. And all these programs are free to these young folks. So it really helps in those underserved public school environments that many cities have, Kansas City included, who couldn't necessarily afford the admission cost to come. And so we have an art program called Project Retrace, where kids come in and they are introduced to the Negro Leagues, and then they're challenged to go back to their classrooms and create works of art that interpret what they learned at the Negro Leagues Museum. And here the thought is not about the quality of the art, but the challenge here is the quality of the thought. So if they draw a line on a sheet of paper and say that this represents segregation and can tell me why, I'm good with that. Mm-hmm. But what we found was that there were these tremendously gifted kids who excel in art. And like we're seeing in so many schools, the creative aspect, art, these things are being kind of phased out because most teachers are now having to teach to testing standards. And so these elements are being de-emphasized. And so here we kind of help spark that creativity. So not only were we getting quality fun, we were getting quality art. And it was the impetus for a professional art exhibit that we later created called Shades of Greatness that's still touring the country today. When we got 27 professional artists from around the country, they went through the same exercise that we take our kids through And we sent them back to the studios and say, okay, tell me what struck you about this story. And, man, they created some amazing works of art, 35 original pieces. It's the first ever professional art exhibition inspired by a collaborative professional art exhibition inspired by the Negro League. So these things have far-reaching impact, even beyond just what we physically do here at the museum with the scores of kids who are being introduced. And, of course, with this emphasis now that we have, and rightfully so, on the importance of diversity and inclusion, what better application is there than this wonderful story of the Negro League?
Well, it sounds like you're making great progress in preserving the heritage and building on it and educating people along the way. And again, as we've said, it's much more than a baseball story. It's an American history story and a cultural story, and really has a lot to inform people about. Bob, how can fans connect with and support the Negro League Baseball Museum? Other than certainly we'd encourage them to go there if they're in the Kansas City area, but how else can they connect and support the museum?
Yeah, no, you can learn more about the Negro League Baseball Museum on the web at NLBM.com. And if you're so inclined, you can follow me on both Twitter and on Instagram, the same username at NLBMPREZ, P-R-E-Z, where we're constantly helping people understand the things that are going on. You know, the museum is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization, and certainly if you would consider, if those listening may consider making a donation to join our team to help keep the legacy of the Negro Leagues alive. We obviously always appreciate those considerations, but there's various ways in which you can learn more about the great work that we're doing here with the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And I do hope that those who are listening, after we move past this coronavirus pandemic, that their travels will bring them to Kansas City to experience, and obviously I'm biased, what I believe to be the best baseball history museum anywhere in the world. And that's no, with no disrespect to my friends at Cooperstown, because obviously it is a hallowed hall, and if you like stuff. But it's this amazing story here that had escaped the pages of American history books that has been so eye-opening for so many when they make this trek to visit the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. It is a very moving experience. But I think you walk away from this experience sharing the power of the human spirit to persevere and prevail.
Well, it's definitely on my list, and I've heard many good compliments about it from people who have visited, and certainly encourage those to who are in the Kansas City area or will travel there to see the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, and certainly to stay connected through NLBM.com to learn more. It's telling a great story, and we hope someday soon, Bob, that the museum will be open again for visitors and that we'll all be out at the ballpark again soon to see those Negro League jerseys and see the celebrations and ceremonies that no doubt you would have planned for this 100th year since the founding of the Negro National League. Bob, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us. It's been a pleasure to talk with you today, and we appreciate you being on.
Keith, it's my absolute pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.